From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR sports program, Only a Game. Trish Carter was a very good amateur cyclist until one day in 2010 when a bicycle versus car accident left her with a serious brain injury.
I wanted to get fit and strong again. I liked being that way. So it came to me, this idea that I could ride up Mount Washington.
How Carter's ride to recovery took her up a very big hill and all the way across the country, coming up on Only a Game, plus a groundbreaking ascent up Mount St. Helens on a snow kite. Stay tuned. What drives competitive amateur athletes? In Trish Carter's case, let's think multiple choice. A, curiosity about how well she can do if she works harder. B, determination to recover from a serious injury. C, desire to prove women of a certain age shouldn't be written off as athletes. And the answer is D, all of the above, and also E, some other stuff. Trish Carter's first experiences as an athlete didn't discourage her, which is sort of amazing.
I was a Title IX baby in Connecticut. I joined the boys' track team. You know, the coach hated the whole idea. And the first day, he tried to shake us all.
But Trish Carter didn't get shaken.
Then I became a half-miler because that was the shortest race you could put more than three competitors in without wasting a lane on a girl. And I'd get out there and, you know, I'd be faster than some kid. So I'd pass him, and invariably, those guys would drop out of the race with shin splints and side aches and all manner of affliction. I was like the plague every time I passed somebody.
Carter passed enough runners to qualify for the state track meet. And?
2 days before the meet, I asked my coach what my lane was going to be. And he said, "Oh, gosh, forgot to send in your card." That was it. I never got to race against girls. I didn't go to the state meets. I always felt like I could have been someone, could have been a contender.
Fast forward to adulthood. Having accepted that running track was out, Trish Carter founded and ran the Dancing Deer Baking Company, famous for its cookies. And absent a discouraging coach, she started competing in marathons as well. And when that started to beat up her knees, she began riding a bike, seriously enough to impress other bike riders.
Someone said, "You, Trish, you ought to race. You're fast." And so I did. I jumped in with no preparation and really no clue what I was doing.
Unfortunately, one day back in 2010, she encountered a motorist who had the same problem, and that combination made for a bicyclist's nightmare.
I was coming into an intersection. I knew the light was about to turn green as it did. I was going fast, and in retrospect, possibly too fast. A car broke the red arrow on the other side and turned left in front of me. So I just had to slam on the brakes, and the bike went flying. I went flying, landed on my head, and kind of everything on my left side was either broken or dislocated or scraped off or rearranged or cracked.
Did you know right away that you were seriously injured?
I suspected.
Her suspicions were correct, and the most serious injury was to her brain. For months, she slept all day. Tests found her processing speed was slow and her executive functioning was compromised.
It wasn't clear whether I would get back to a professional career.
Carter would eventually lose her company, though not because of the injury, because in this particular case, pessimism lost out to patience and therapy.
I did, over time, get my brain back. I think it's better than ever, slightly rearranged.
Maybe Carter should have been leery of climbing back on a bicycle, and she was for a little while, and then she wasn't.
I wanted to get fit and strong again. I liked being that way. So it came to me, this idea that I could ride up Mount Washington, that that would be an adequate goal and help me make this recovery.
Trish Carter's rearranged brain figured out that falling off a bike headed slowly uphill wouldn't be a big deal. Even if that hill was a mountain, climbing it wouldn't be as dangerous as speeding through a busy intersection, and a tumble wouldn't hurt much.
It's more of a tilt over than it is an accident.
So she did, in fact, take on the 2011 Mount Washington Auto Road Bicycle Hill Climb, described as one of the two toughest hill climbs in the world.
I came across the summit finish line, and I don't know, other than having my two children, that there was ever a more glorious, rewarding, emotional moment. I knew that this was all part of my asserting to myself that I was okay, that I could do stuff. I wasn't a failure. It was some kind of a point of inflection in my life.
So there she was at the top of Mount Washington, and for anyone else, it might have been all downhill from there, but not for Trish Carter. She heard about a competition called the Race Across America, RAM for short, but it isn't short because it goes from Oceanside, California to Annapolis, Maryland. Carter had friends who had completed the race, and one day she went to check on their times. The results were categorized by age group.
As I was scrolling through, I became aware of seeing no women's names after I passed the 50s. Hmm. And I went back and I looked again. And there were no, at the time I thought, there were no women that had ever competed successfully in RAM.
That turned out to be a misreading. Two women did complete the 2011 RAM, and Carter did eventually discover her mistake.
But it was too late because I had already been gripped with this idea that that was not acceptable. Somebody had to change that fact. That was it. I just decided I had to do it. That's not entirely true. I thought about it for a little while. I tried to talk myself out of it.
But you were unsuccessful.
I was unsuccessful. I just couldn't let it go.
So Trish Carter signed up for the 2017 edition of RAM, which would begin in June. She put together a four-person team of riders and a support group of a dozen or so others. Carter, by that time 60, decided that the riders and some of the support team should all be about the same age she was. Before she set out, she was humble about that goal of being the first team of women over 60 to finish the RAM.
It's not much, but it's a thing that can be done. Ralph Waldo Emerson said, "Do the thing and you will have the power," or something like that. Just push the edge a little bit in a positive direction. Obviously, if a few people look up and say, "Oh my God, I can't believe a woman could ride a bicycle across the country at that speed," that'll be good too.
Agreed, no doubt about it. But in order for that to happen, Trish Carter and her team would have to ride bicycles from one end of the country to the other in 7 days. This would require a support team able to... Hey, but hey, you're curious about how the ride worked out, right? And I was too. So a few weeks after this summer's race, I reconnected with Carter. Trish Carter, this is Bill Littlefield. How are you?
Hey, Bill.
How are you doing?
How are you? Great.
I'm okay. I expected you to answer tired.
Maybe still somewhat in recovery.
About a third of the entries didn't finish the race. Trish Carter and her team did.
Remarkably, yes. Exhausted, completely spent, but great. And grateful that I was there, alive, safe, that I'd made it.
And it could have been ugly. and it sometimes is.
And sometimes it isn't.
The Milky Way is so big and the sky is so magnificent out west, and we didn't have a full moon, but we had a decent amount of starlight.
They rode through desert heat and tropical storms. They rode against a 30-mile-an-hour wind blowing across Kansas, and as the race wore on, sleep became more essential and hygiene more optional.
The first night before I stretched out, I brushed my teeth and washed my face and flossed my teeth. Second night, it wasn't worth the floss part. I knew I could get through without that. It wasn't worth the lost sleep. So you can just take it from there. Everybody carved it down to the bare essentials.
The challenges for the riders, four women, all at or near eligibility for that senior discount at the movies, are obvious. Those facing the members of the support team may be less dramatic, but Trish Carter wanted to talk about them.
Two of the drivers were women in their late 60s and two were guys. And I talked to a number of people on the crew who later admitted that when they saw these two lovely women, just perfectly wonderful people, charming, show up, somewhere they had a reaction in their brains, which was, uh-oh, this is not going to work too well. And they didn't have that reaction about the guys.
And they shouldn't have had that reaction about the women who had to drive for 10 to 14 hours at a stretch, stay precisely where they belonged, in front of and behind the riders, and keep track of what those athletes needed and wanted and when.
As it turned out, these very amazing women were rock stars, and they even didn't drink much so that they wouldn't have to stop too often. They ended up being the ultimate authority on really what was happening all the time. And by the end of the race, we have a funny picture of some of the younger folk on the team literally bowing down before them. You know, they completely blew away their expectations. And we had this little microcosm within our crew, our 19 people, we had a microcosm of what we were trying to do in the larger world around us.
It's a fine image that microcosm is for a big goal, teaching people not to stereotype or underestimate folks based on gender or age. And speaking of goals, Carter and her team raised tens of thousands of dollars for gender-specific medical research. But the more Trish Carter and I talked, the clearer it became that her personal goals were linked with that microcosm. She had recovered from an accident that damaged her brain and from various other losses less dramatic. Now maybe she could celebrate. Last time we spoke also, you mentioned that you've always felt like you could have been a contender. now that you've raced across the country, I don't know if you still feel like a contender or if you feel like a champ.
I don't know. I look, that's just me. I'm always going to feel like there's the next category that I should be stepping up to. I did something. It was great. It was big and a very solid performance. I feel like the other people are the real elite athletes, and I'm just kind of hanging out in the neighborhood.
Just hanging out in the neighborhood. Well, not really. The day after the race across America, Trish Carter went to work at the baking company in New Haven, where she's the CEO. Bread this time, rather than cookies, she says, and I should drop in someday. But that's not all she says when she looks ahead.
I don't know the big next. I had thought I would be really wasted and not interested in racing this summer. And about a week ago, I jumped on my bike on a lark and went over to East Rock, which is about a 400-foot climb and a little over a mile. And I thought, well, let me see how fast I can go. And I zipped up it.
You probably don't have to be told Carter timed herself on that ride up East Rock or that she turned in a personal best. But just in case you do, she did. You're listening to Only a Game from NPR. I'd like to thank Johnny Run for leaving the following review on iTunes. What a pleasure it is to listen to a podcast that talks about original sports-related news. There's only so much one can bear of a certain ballplayer's dad. This is a safe place away from all that. Wait, who could you possibly mean, Johnny Run? Could it be this guy?
He said one leg. I told him I could beat him with one hand tied behind my back, with some glasses on, with one eye lens out, with some flip-flops on in the rain.
Are you being serious?
Enough. More than enough. Consider visiting iTunes and leaving a review of your own. It's the best way to help other listeners find our show. I'm Bill Littlefield, and it's time for Three Stories You Should Know. This week, we're going to talk about a couple of quarterbacks, one who has been the subject of outrage and the other the subject of ridicule. My guests are SB Nation's Charlotte Wilder and Mike Pesca. He's the host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Happy to be here.
I think we should start with outrage. So, Mike, you're up.
Outrage could apply to either of these quarterbacks because they are quarterbacks. We like to put a lot on their shoulders, especially when they're 20 years old. That's the case of Josh Rosen, UCLA quarterback. And he did an interview, and he's been outspoken in the past. He doesn't like Trump. Speaks his mind. Ask him a question, he'll answer it. So Bleacher Report was asking about academics and football. And he said, look, football and school don't go together. They just don't. Trying to do both is like trying to do two full-time jobs. No one in their right mind should have a football player's schedule and go to school. This is not, to my mind, that controversial. The NCAA mandates that you can only legitimately practice 20 hours a week. But when you do the math about how much you have to put in, it's really 50 hours a week. That's a full-time job. What Josh Rosen always gets is blowback. So Danny Cannell, who is a former NFL and college quarterback and also a sports talker type guy, went on Twitter and blasted Josh Rosen and said, essentially, do more on the field. How many people would love to be in your position to have a scholarship? Mm-hmm. I looked up an article from 1995. This was when Danny Cannell was a senior at FSU. He says, people don't realize how much time we put in to prepare. It's really tough. The 20-hour rule is one thing, but there is all that extra time we go to voluntarily. It takes every moment to try to do your best in school. It got kind of hard trying to study up in the library. I don't know how many people came up to me and asked me for an autograph. Mm. So maybe Cannell's not being hypocritical. Maybe just forgot what it was like to be 22 years old.
I think that something that kind of drives me crazy about sports media in general is that there's this desire to jump on anyone who says something that might not toe the party line. And yeah, to me, this is an obvious statement. Of course, these are two jobs. To pretend that being a football player in college is about an education is ridiculous at this point. You know, it's a feeder to the league, but you don't have to pay the guys. And I mean, I could barely go to class in college, and like that was my only job. It was like a good day if right. I got to my 9 a.m. class.
Are and you so, listening, Dad?
Yeah, I know. Sorry, Mom and Dad. I swear I went. But, you know, to me, it's just I can't imagine balancing a 50-hour time commitment. And I don't dispute that I'm sure some of these guys, and most of them, a lot of them, you know, want to go to class or want to give it their all, but there's just not enough energy that one person has.
It wasn't that long ago that an Ohio State player said, and I'm quoting, "We're here to play football, not play school." Maybe if enough other players express the same sort of thing, eventually it's going to help the development of a system that's not as hypocritical and unfair and silly as the one we have now. Mike, what are the chances that we are actually moving in that direction?
It doesn't seem to be. That player, Cardale Jones, actually tweeted at Josh Rosen the words, "Chill, bro, play school." So, which tells me it's mostly about things you don't say. I mean, when Rosen's coach, Jim Mara, he was on the Dan Patrick Show, he was talking all about how I don't think Josh's opinions have changed. It's about how you express them. You have to realize you have a platform and you don't want to say things like that. Like what? Honestly, and from the heart, it's true. Like from the coach's perspective, don't ever create any controversy or say anything, even if it is true, that might distract or detract.
All right, on to ridicule. And Charlotte, this is your topic. Off you go.
Oh, yeah, it's so bizarre that I landed on ridicule. So I think not on brand at all. So I was on vacation this week, and when I landed on Monday, I open up Twitter and I see that Jay Cutler has signed a $10 million one-year deal with the Miami Dolphins. He's come out of retirement. And the picture of Cutler at his press conference, he's standing there in front of the backdrop that has one of the sponsors is AARP, which I just cracked me up. And he's standing there and he's making the Jay Cutler face. And if you don't know what the Jay Cutler face is, it's he looks sort of just perennially either a dad saying like, "I'm not mad, I'm just disappointed," or you know, I joked on Twitter that he looked like a fifth year senior who had to go back because he hadn't completed all the core requirements. But he was also the subject. There was this Tumblr that someone made a few years ago where they just photoshopped cigarettes into Jay Cutler's sort of downturned mouth, and it became a whole thing. So the internet just had a field day with this. And at the press conference, he says, "The good thing is I play quarterback, so I don't have to be in that great cardiovascular shape." I just really identified with Jay Cutler in that moment. But I'm just like, Jay, man, what are you doing? And here's $10 million. Go play football for a year. You know, well, we wish you well.
Well, that's apparently what he's doing. Mike, right. How do you feel about this?
Well, it's weird that he would say we didn't have to be in great cardiovascular shape. We know he likes riding the stationary bike on the sidelines, and that certainly should get a good resting heart rate. So I think with quarterbacks, I feel bad for these guys. They're like, I decided to play football. It's the sport where you can't see my face. But of course, everyone can see their face. So you have to have three things. You have to have the good face, you have to have the good attitude, and your deeds have to be good. Jay Cutler might fail on all three. In my hometown, Eli Manning has the bad face. He always shows how perturbed he is. Mm. But his actions are really good. And his words, he never says the wrong thing ever. So, you know, if you have two out of three and two Super Bowls, we forgive you. But if you're Jay Cutler and maybe on occasion you dog it and some of your teammates don't like you and you look all perturbed on the sideline, you know, you're going to spawn a lot of memes.
At the risk of piling on, I really liked it when at that same press conference, I guess, Jay Cutler said one of his priorities was figuring out where the dinner room is. I think it's important to have a quarterback with a good appetite.
He's
no
like,
question.
Here are the things I care about. Where's the food? And also being in just okay enough shape to do my job.
All right. I have some good news. I am more optimistic than I was last week about the intelligence of the public. The secondary market for tickets to see Conor McGregor box for the first time in his life has been flooded before the primary market has even sold out. Ticketmaster doesn't want you to know how bad sales have been. They've hidden that little interactive map that you usually get that shows how many seats are available and where. The Mayweather camp says ticket sales are going just fine, thank you very much. Maybe this is all happening, or I should say not happening, because the tickets are too expensive. I prefer to think that the glut of tickets so far unsold is the result of a sudden realization on the part of the public that this exhibition between a boxer and a guy who's never boxed before in his life is a fraudulent exercise best ignored. Will either or both of you join me in celebrating this incredible outburst of good sense? Charlotte, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, if that's what's happening, you know, unless it really is that it's just too expensive and people are like, nah. I mean, I've kind of thought the whole time, and I am not alone in this, I don't think that this is, you know, a spectacle, and what more money can we make off of this sort of novelty match? And I know some people are excited. I think some people just want McGregor to, like, kick Mayweather in the face. I have trouble with Mayweather's domestic violence history. I really think celebrating, and I know that gets into the like, well, then how do you listen to musicians who've done terrible things? So I realize that it's sort of a tricky needle to thread, but I've said I don't know if I'm going to watch it, and then I feel like I'll end up getting sucked into it and watching it, but I would not buy a ticket. So I hope that maybe other people are also deciding not to do so.
I think it's all the pricing, because if you look at the pay-per-view projections, there are some people saying this could set the all-time record. It will almost certainly be an above 3 million viewer pay-per-view, which puts him in the category of, you know, Mayweather-Pacquiao, maybe a De La Hoya fight. It's clearly the fact that they've priced the tickets in the thousands. So, hey, if you want to be optimistic and think it says something good about the sense of your fellow American, I understand that. But to me, it's like an IQ test written in a foreign language. it doesn't really tell you much.
You ever taken one of those?
I was above grade level. That's all I want to say.
Oh, nice. Congrats. Right.
I'm going to close this out just by saying that I hope by even mentioning this topic, we haven't inadvertently promoted this stupid, witless exhibition. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been SB Nation's Charlotte Wilder and Mike Pesca, who is the host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist. Thank you, both of you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for having me, Bill. Always a pleasure.
Our next story is about a guy who loves to play baseball, and when he hit, it sounded like this. But now, it sounds like this. Here's Only a Game's Gary Wallach with the story.
As far back as Christian Thaxton can remember, he's had a baseball bat in his hands.
I like to joke that I was swinging before I was walking, basically, right?
Christian grew up playing baseball in his Oklahoma backyard with his brothers. He played in high school and at Redlands Community College in El Reno, Oklahoma. As a freshman, he worked his way into the lineup as the starting DH. Things were going well for Christian until April of 2013.
I always crushed the inside pitch. That was the pitch I turned on. And I started just losing it halfway to the plate. So I'd start swinging, and it would just disappear and just totally throw me off.
All hitters go through slumps, but then
I started noticing kind of a dark spot in my eye. At that point, it was like, okay, something's definitely going on here.
Christian consulted with a neuro-ophthalmologist who told him he had a viral infection and that the dark spot in his right eye would go away.
I was still driving. I was still in school. I could do everything. I was still a sighted person. And so I was just like, oh, I'm going to give it a couple months. A couple months later, it hadn't cleared up and it actually gotten larger. Now there's a spot in my left eye. And it's like, what's going on?
On October 15th, 2013, Christian drove to his doctor's. He was diagnosed with Leber's optic neuropathy, which typically affects men in their late teens. The doctor told him that he'd soon lose most of his vision and that the loss would most likely be permanent.
I was just taken aback. I was floored. It was just, what do you mean I'm going blind?
Christian got back into his car and drove home for what would be the last time in his life.
And I just collapsed on my bed. I just broke down and started crying because I just had no idea what going blind would be like. And all these things were racing through my head, how I'd never play sports again, how, you know, what does this mean for school?
And you were how old on that day?
It would have been my 20th birthday.
Christian withdrew from his classes at Redlands and moved back with his family. Most mornings, he wasn't motivated to get out of bed. He struggled to use his computer and smartphone. He rarely left the house, not even to go to his brother's baseball games.
Because it was this very real loss I had experienced. This is something I can't do anymore. This huge part of my life is no longer there.
Christian and his parents considered his next step. Maybe low vision skills training in Louisiana or near home in Oklahoma. But he was looking elsewhere.
I've always had these high expectations and hopes and dreams for my own life of what I would be, what I would accomplish.
Christian felt staying in Oklahoma would be the safe move, so he decided to enroll in a 16-week program at the Carroll Center for the Blind, located in the Boston suburb of Newton. In the winter of 2015, Christian headed east.
It was a nightmare getting out here because I was during that huge snowstorm in 2015 toward the end of it. My mom dropped me off at the airport. She saw me get on the plane and then left.
That first flight was delayed by 5 hours, and then it got worse.
And that entire time, I was totally by myself. So first time flying, new to blindness, and I'm stuck in airports for about 12 hours that day. So it was an interesting first hurdle to get out here.
When he arrived at the Carroll Center, Christian began learning Braille and relearning how to cook and clean.
It was a really eye-opening experience that first day there, just hearing what these different people did for careers and how they went through college and what they're doing now with their lives.
Christian says that baseball was the last thing on his mind. But then he met members of the Boston Renegades. They play a sport called beep baseball.
I was like, oh, that's cool. I'd never heard of it before. But I was like, you know, this sounds like a really great opportunity, really great experience. I'm going to go try this out, see what it's about.
I went to a Renegades practice, and here's what I saw. Each team has members with varying degrees of vision loss, along with its own sighted pitcher and a sighted catcher who sets the target where a batter is accustomed to swing. The pitcher's goal is to place the ball on the hitter's bat, and the balls beep.
Set. Ready. Pitch.
After making contact, a batter runs to a buzzing 4-foot-high padded base. Bases are located 10 feet off of each foul line to keep runners and fielders from colliding. In the field, sighted spotters help direct fielders toward beeping balls and away from each other.
Over!
When Christian first tried out for the Renegades, he had no idea what to expect. But he knew what he wanted to do.
A ball coming off the bat was one of my favorite feelings, when you just connect with one and it just shoots off the bat. And so I get up there and I swing, and the first pitch I hit again. And the best way I can describe it is a dream come true. I got to hit a moving ball again.
And he got much more than that.
Yeah, you know, I grew up in sports, and this is the closest knit team that I've played on. All of a sudden, be thrown in with 15 other blind people to help explore what was going on in my life. To have that is amazing. And so you're gaining much more than just this competitive game. You're gaining friends and a family of sorts.
Christian's new family includes an accessibility program coordinator for Boston's public transit system. There's also a phys ed instructor and a man who recently graduated from Harvard with a PhD in theoretical particle physics. He says they're all teaching him how to live with blindness. In July, the men and women of the Renegades traveled to Florida for the Beep Baseball World Series. They came in fifth out of a 22-team field. I asked Christian how he did.
I had a fair amount of success throughout the World Series.
That's an understatement. Even though his team didn't come out on top, Christian was the series MVP. He batted a ridiculous .897 over seven games, breaking a record that had stood for 21 years. He's modest, too.
I need to work on my defense.
And on his education. He has one semester left at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, to earn his degree in information systems. In December, he'll begin searching for a job in project management or business analytics. Just 4 years ago, Christian Thaxton hadn't seen much beyond the well-worn base paths of an Oklahoma ball field. Just 2 years ago, he was struggling to come to terms with blindness. And now?
While I would take my vision back without a second thought, it's just been a huge positive transformation in my life. One that, while I was going through it, I never saw coming. You know, one of the worst things that's ever happened to me has made me a better person, and I think I'm going to be better off for having gone through it.
For Only a Game, I'm Gary Wallach.
In April, Aaron Sales set out to become the first person to reach the summit of Mount St. Helens on a snow kite.
500 vertical feet from the summit, I realized, I think I'm going to make it. There's no reason I shouldn't be able to make it.
But getting to the summit was the easy part. That's just ahead on Only a Game. And remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
Hi, I'm Erica Lance, and I think you might like this podcast I produce, also from WBUR, called Kind World. Kind World tells deeply personal stories about the pivotal moments in our lives.
She called me one day and she says, "Why are you choosing to live in our grief?" And I said, "I'm not. I'm choosing to live in your love."
All of those women were witness to the darkest and probably most intimate moment of my life, and they gave me a sliver of light.
I talked to all kinds of people about times when they felt alone or scared or overwhelmed, and how they got through it with the help of others.
I even thought I was a little crazy. But then I'm like, wait, I could do anything I want. I could raise $1 million if I want to. I could cure this disease.
I think that he bypassed all that and just said, I see a human being who needs my help, and I'm going to help him.
Head over to WBUR.org/kindworld or just subscribe in your favorite podcast app.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, Bill Walton tells the story of how he conquered his most vicious foe. But right now it's time for my discussion of the week's news with Charlie Pierce. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
The NFL preseason is underway. God help us. And quarterback Colin Kaepernick.
A day of raucous celebration around the Littlefield, man.
Anyway, Colin Kaepernick, who knelt during the playing of the national anthem before games last season when he was a 49er, remains without a team. Sociologist Harry Edwards said this week it's outrageous for a league that welcomes back felons and rapists to freeze out Colin Kaepernick. Do you share his perspective?
Yeah, this is preposterous at this point. He is being blackballed. Everybody knows he's being blackballed. Nobody believes the NFL management when it says anything, let alone anything about this. I am enormously sympathetic to Colin Kaepernick, but I am not surprised at all that this is happening.
I think the only question is, did all of the general managers and owners in the league come to this conclusion on their own, or was there actually collusion and an agreement not to employ this guy?
Well, you're obviously not familiar with the NFL hive mind. Resistance is futile, and they don't need to conspire to make this decision individually. Basically, they're a bunch of, you know, extremely rich automobile dealers or members of the Lucky Sperm Club, and they haven't had to think for an awfully long time.
Don Baylor passed away on Monday. He was 68 years old. Many will remember him as the guy who's fourth on Major League Baseball's all-time hit-by-a-pitch career leaders list with a stunning 267 of those. He should be remembered, of course, for a fine 19-year career in which he was an MVP and a World Series champion, I think, don't you?
Yes, and he was also a manager. He was a great mentor to younger players. He was an MVP one year. He had a remarkable career, and he was one of the great combinations of growly bear and gentleness that I've ever met when he spent his year with the Red Sox.
On Tuesday, right-handed pitcher Ernesto Friere was sold by the Texas Rangers to the Seattle Mariners for a dollar. if you're Seattle, you don't want to be giving this guy an inferiority complex, right? Why not offer, oh, I don't know, $11, something?
Please tell me the dollar bill is hanging in his locker. Please tell me they didn't write a check for this guy. But we're moving ever closer to the day when a player actually is traded for a bag of baseballs.
On Wednesday, a stray cat wandered onto the Busch Stadium field during a game between the Cardinals and the Royals. One pitch after the cat was whisked off the field by a member of the ground/cat crew, Yadier Molina hit a game-winning grand slam. And now the Cardinals are calling the thing the rally cat, and they can't find it. It's gone.
Of course not, because if you look at the video, the cat completely mauls the poor guy who had to go pick him up. So I suspect that cat was released with great relief by the people who actually had to do the work of catching him. The Cardinals are just going to have to blunder along without dangerous, insane rally cat.
The captain of the Mexican men's soccer team has been accused of having ties to a drug cartel. His assets in the U.S. have been frozen. This is Rafa Marquez, of course, formerly of the New York Red Bulls of MLS, and before that, FC Barcelona. He has denied the charges, even though the sport involved is soccer. This is pro soccer, so we can't blame this one on FIFA. Or can we? Can we?
No, I mean, but you know, there. We have to admit that there are other organized crime cartels out there in the world besides FIFA. And some of them are really very dangerous and carry guns, and this is one of them.
Video gaming may be an Olympic sport in time for the Paris Games in 2024.
No.
So, any predictions as to which athletes will become the first Olympic medalists in Pac-Man, Centipede, or The Legend of Zelda?
Oh, how old are you? I have every confidence that the International Olympic Committee will bow to television and actually put this farce on. I have no intention of watching it, however.
Last week, Bull Bullard of the Harlem Globetrotters launched a basketball from 210 feet above the rim that found nothing but net. No big deal, you might say. YouTube is, of course, full of people throwing basketballs through hoops from great heights. But he threw this one from a helicopter. That's pretty cool.
That is very cool. And right afterwards, he dumped a huge bucket of confetti down on the people below.
Pretending it was water. I know the trick.
Exactly.
Yeah. How long before the Olympics includes helicopter hoops?
Hey, I'll take helicopter hoops ahead of video games.
Yeah, me too.
I think it'd be great. Helicopters dodging each other like Quidditch.
It's great.
While guys try to hit baskets.
And finally, Charlie, Taipei's Summer University Games begin next week, and the games include swimming, soccer, archery, lots of other sports as well. And as part of a promotional campaign, Taiwan commuters have been riding in trains with floors that simulate some of the venues, a baseball diamond in one, a swimming pool in the other. Sounds like commuting might be kind of fun there.
It certainly would be refreshing, if not cool. I don't know. I mean, this is a little bit strange, actually, but I think you're seeing pretty much what the venues for Olympic video games are going to be looking like in Paris.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pearson, Sports Illustrated, from time to time, and he joins me each week, of course, on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Paul.
Let us know what you think of Only a Game. Subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a review. You can also join our online community on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR. For the past decade, Aaron Sales has been trying to do something no one else has ever done, in part because it never occurred to anybody else to do it. It's an intense, crazy feat, but Aaron had his reasons. Eilish O'Neill brings us his story from Hood River, Oregon.
On May 18th, 1980, Aaron Sales was a 6-year-old kid living in Kennewick, Washington. His family was driving home from church when a cloud of ash started to form over the town.
But as the big cloud came closer and closer, and then the ash started falling, pretty soon we had an inch of ash all over the ground, and we were outside playing in it with my brother and my neighbors.
Mount St. Helens had just erupted.
A blast heard as far away as Vancouver, British Columbia, a blast some say that rocked the courthouse in Port Angeles. Smoke and ash billowed 66,000 feet, almost 10 miles above the summit of the 9,600-foot mountain.
57 people died and 200 homes were destroyed in the eruption. The event sparked Aaron's lifelong fascination with the mountain.
In my mind, it's a female. I refer to Mount St. Helens as a her. And I feel like when I'm up there, it's like we talk, and it's like she welcomes me. And I know it sounds a little weird, like talking to a mountain, but that's kind of that inner voice you have.
During the week, Aaron works for a company he co-founded, devising and guiding outdoor team-building adventures for employees of other companies. Aaron tells me he works in an office at least part of the week, but he always spends his Sundays in the mountains.
Church for me is being up on the mountain. That's where I am connected and most thankful.
In his teens and early 20s, Aaron went to the mountains primarily to snowboard. Then, looking for a way to train during the summer, he took up kiteboarding, riding a board while holding onto a massive kite so the wind could pull him along the water. It was 15 years ago when he became one of the first to put the two sports together and snow kite, that is, ride a snowboard while strapped to a massive kite that can pull him across fields of snow and up and down mountains. His kites have a bar that he uses like a tiller in a sailboat. He can turn the bar to steer left and right to tack against the wind.
Snow kiting gives you these superhuman powers. If you go to the top of a hill, get a little bit of speed going down the mountain and put the kite above you, it sends you directly into flight. And then all of a sudden it's completely silent in the air. Sometimes it feels like everything goes into slow motion. And believe me, when I'm up snow kiting, I'm not thinking about work. Like, you have to be so on with every movement.
That's because the kite's lines can get tangled, making it impossible to steer. Or the kite can lift the kiter off the mountain or pull him off the edge of a glacier or into a crevasse. Snow kiting requires big open spaces above tree line. That's so the kite doesn't get tangled up in branches. And those open spaces tend to be the perfect places to set off an avalanche.
I'm definitely a risk taker. I mean, if you're not taking risks in life, I think life is boring. So I hope I live a long life, and I hope I'm wild and crazy and still taking risks at 70 years old. I carry a picture of my daughters every time I go up on the mountains as a reminder that, hey, it's just not worth it unless all the conditions align and it's a perfect day.
About 10 years ago, Aaron was on Mount St. Helens, snow kiting back and forth without any particular aim, when he got a crazy idea. In all of his years of obsession with Mount St. Helens, he'd never been to the top, and he decided that someday he'd snow kite there.
If anybody should do it, it should be me. It needs to be me. It's my idea, and so I need to get to the top and do it. I want to push the limits of my physical and mental ability. Can your mind hold up for 35 minutes getting to the top? You know, at what point do you freak out and say, gosh, this feels like avalanche conditions, I should turn around, or like, this is really steep.
Over the past decade, Aaron's gone back to the mountain at least a dozen times to try to summit. But every time, something has gone wrong. Some days, the wind wasn't strong enough to pull him up. Other days, the wind was too strong and it seemed dangerous to attempt a summit. Once, his kite got caught on a rocky ledge and he had to pull his safety release so he wouldn't follow his kite into a crevasse. This April, Aaron decided to make one more attempt. The day seemed perfect. The weather forecast was favorable. The mountain pass between Hood River, where he lives, and Mount St. Helens had just been plowed. So he and three of his buddies set off just after sunrise. They got to the mountain around 9.
There's really this nervous energy, and it's like you want to pack everything right, and you're all excited.
Aaron and his friends rode snowmobiles up to a snowfield above treeline so they could unpack and unfurl their kites. That's the first time they could actually see the summit.
We realized, is that a cloud on the summit? No, it's snow swirling. It looked like it was blowing at least 30 miles an hour on the top of the mountain.
Aaron wasn't prepared for such strong winds, but he decided to go anyway. So he and his friends started unpacking their kites. Brad Gordon planned to ride up with Aaron that day, on skis instead of a snowboard. He's a professional backcountry skier who's worked on rescue patrols, and he's been snow kiting for 15 years. But the binding on one of his skis was broken, and he wouldn't be able to ride. He told himself,
first world problems, right? It's like, you're in the mountains with your friends, you're gonna have some fun times, yeah, your binding broke. Immediately I thought of like, okay, well, we're gonna pull this off, and we're gonna pull it off safely. How can I help Aaron?
So Brad made a new plan. He'd take another friend, who'd come along to take photos, on his snowmobile, and he'd drop him off halfway up the mountain. He didn't dare go any further for fear of setting off an avalanche. Meanwhile, Aaron discovered he had a gear problem too. He'd meant to grab a big kite for the weak wind he'd expected, but
when I was packing it, I was all nervous.
And he'd messed up and grabbed a much smaller kite, one he doubted he could get started in the gentle winds blowing for the first couple of miles. He decided to go for it anyway. He started slowly, but then he hit the real wind.
I had a lot of different natural features to navigate. There's canyons, there's ridges, there's cliffs. 500 vertical feet from the summit, I realized, I think I'm going to make it. There's no reason I shouldn't be able to make it. And you just start getting this funny, tingly feeling where you know that the finish line is in sight.
But as Aaron approached the summit, he faced a new problem.
Most mountains, when you reach the top, you're in a really large place to go and hang out. Mount St. Helens is really unique in that when you reach the crater rim, it's a knife's edge. If something were to go wrong and my kite dragged me out of control, it's a 1,500-foot drop over the backside and into the crater. I mean, it's certain death at that point.
Aaron had planned to quick release his kite at the top of the mountain, letting the kite fly away.
But I've actually, to be honest, never pulled my safety release in 40 knots of wind. Those are usually conditions you don't kite in.
Aaron wasn't sure what he was going to do, but as he approached the rim, he saw someone standing in the distance. He was easy to spot, 6'2" with his arms up. It was Brad. Brad had decided that the risk of Aaron flying off the mountain was greater than the risk of setting off an avalanche, and so he'd taken a snowmobile to the top to try and catch Aaron's kite.
It kind of felt like the mountain was a little bit upset or angry that we were up there because the wind was just really ripping.
It was so windy, Brad worried he might not catch the kite.
I felt like I was the little kid in the Little League World Series catching the pop fly because here comes the ball, and I knew I had one shot to catch this kite. I've caught hundreds and hundreds of kites, but this one, I knew it was mandatory and crucial to catch that kite right there.
Aaron steered the kite toward Brad, and Brad caught it. But he felt the danger still wasn't over.
And I've got this kite just raging in my hands, and the lines were kind of getting tangled, and it was really, really windy. And I got kind of emotional a little bit because I knew Aaron would be super stoked, and knew I thought he would belt out like a yell or something. But he was just giggling.
So much was going through my mind of like, one, I can't believe that just happened. I just did it to finally looking inside the crater and seeing the dome, and this is something I've been visualizing for years, and then to actually see it, I really felt like I was in a dream state, and I can't think of any other experiences in my life where I felt that alive.
And I said, Aaron, we got to get some photos, we got to get your photo, and let's get off this mountain, because it just didn't feel safe. You know, it didn't feel safe being up there holding this kite, and, you know, I wanted to take the air out of it and pack it up.
Brad rode his snowmobile down, and Aaron snowboarded. He says he came down in more ways than one.
The day afterwards was almost like going through somewhat of a depression. It's like, well, now what? Like, I'm sitting on a couch, and yesterday I was on the top of a mountain. It was really like, okay, I just accomplished something I've been working on for 10 years. I just felt like there was this big gap. There was this big hole. It's just really weird to go from the best day of your life to like, oh, God, now what do I do with my life?
Aaron says he's figured it out. He next wants to snow kite up Mount Adams in Washington State and Mount Fuji in Japan. For Only a Game, I'm Alicia O'Neill.
Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal, and our intern is Philip Goldberg. Our senior producer is Karen Given. Our final word this week comes from Beep Baseball star Christian Thaxton, who remembers his first day at the Carroll Center for the Blind.
And so I walk in, and there's a ton of blind people.
One indication that he was in the right place. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports NPR style on Only a Game, and thanks for listening.